the Colossus Clapper on Facebook, just this line. And we, you know, had not too stringent assumptions on this, but you'll remember what we did to establish phase coexistence. There were three criteria. If we had two phases in contact that were in equilibrium with each other, they needed to be in thermal equilibrium, diffusive equilibrium, and mechanical equilibrium, which meant temperature, pressure, and chemical potential had to be equal. So that's generally true. Two phases touching each other that are different have to have the same temperature, the same pressure, and the same chemical potential. So using that condition, we derived the Clausius Clapeyron phase coexistence line. And we simply said, look, the chemical potential is a function of pressure and temperature. So we took a Taylor expansion of the chemical potential along the phase coexistence line and derived that. We also saw a gas sublimation. We got into the van der Waals equation of state, where we corrected the ideal gas law a little bit based on these two ideas, that particles really have a finite volume associated with them, not zero volume. Also, when particles get close enough, they feel van der Waals forces, and they're a little bit attracted to each other. So these two corrections led to this correction to the ideal gas equation. So this is the van der Waals equation of state. Equation of state just means van der Waals's souped up ideal gas law. So P equals N tau over V minus NV. So the volume was corrected by a small amount for the fact that particles have finite volume and can't quite explore the entire volume of the container. Minus N squared A over V squared. This was like an attractive interaction between the particles. And then this was the free energy that comes out of those two considerations. So, and when we talked about how geckos walk around and stick to things, and they stick to things by van der Waals forces. And, you know, van der Waals won a Nobel Prize for his work, and that was a great boon, but, you know, really, geckos are the best thing that's happened to the van der Waals forces since the Nobel Prize was awarded for. So this is, we talked about how these guys walk around. And van der Waals forces are the idea that when two molecules or atoms get close to each other, they have fluctuating dipole moments. That is, the electron cloud is shifted a little bit off the nucleus, gives you a little bit of distance between the net positive charge and the net negative charge. And then the two dipole moments of the two molecules or two atoms close to each other start fluctuating together, okay? And then that increases the attraction between them. One of the things we talked about two lectures ago that I never did bring in the visual aids for was some of these liquid crystal phases. So you'll only need a couple of pieces of pasta here for this one. So I have here, I think this is rotini. And you'll notice that each piece of rotini has a handedness to it. That is, the little rotini pasta is like a screw with a particular handedness to it. And when I say handedness, I mean, you know, if the angle of the tilt is heading that way and I kind of wrap my fingers around it, that's a handedness to it. I can't mimic that with my left hand, so this is a right-handed piece of pasta. And remember that handedness is handedness, so when I flip the pasta upside down, it has the same handedness. Okay? So I flip it upside down, and it's still a right-handed piece of pasta. So all of those pieces of pasta, take a couple and pass the bag around so people can take a couple. What I want you to try out is to notice that you need to get two pieces that are pretty good matched. Maybe mine aren't quite so well matched. But we talked about how sometimes liquid crystal phases form a pneumatic, where the little molecules are all roughly pointing in the same direction, but sometimes they also form a twisted pneumatic. The twisted pneumatic is when you have handed molecules, like these guys. And when they get close together, if you squish them a little bit, you'll see that it's a little bit easier for them to twist one way as opposed to the other way when they're close to each other. And it's simply an effect of the handedness. So these are really small for you to see, but if I put them right on top of each other, and then I try to twist them one way, yeah, that's not so stable. If I twist them the other way, they kind of get closer to each other. They're more stable if I twist them one way versus the other way. So this kind of handedness is exactly what leads to twisted pneumatic phases in liquid crystals. So grab a couple of pieces of pasta, try it out, pass the pasta around the class. Are there any questions from last time? Okay. So we mostly talked about van der Waals. Today we'll look more at the van der Waals equation of state, and we will see how it leads to liquid gas phase transitions. And the van der Waals equation of state ends up being something that can capture this idea that there's a liquid gas transition, and yet It doesn't always happen. There's a way to sneak around the transition. Remember, we discussed that in the phase diagram of water. There's part of the phase diagram of water. Well, I probably have it on a slide later. Yes. Part of the phase diagram of water shows a direct transition between liquid and gas. But there's also what's called a critical point, which is the end of that phase transition. And beyond that, we simply call it a fluid because we can't tell the difference between liquid and gas. The van der Waals equation captures that kind of physics, so we will look at that and derive the phase transition as well as the critical point where the phase transition goes away. Then we're going to get into more philosophy of science issues along the lines of, does reductionism really work? What I'm going to argue to you is that reductionism is actually false. I'll tell you what reductionism is and then why it's inadequate for a lot of recent discoveries. And also, how do we define a phase of a state of matter? And what I'll argue is that one way to do this is to classify things according to their symmetries. And this is actually the reason why we can't really tell the difference between liquid and gas. Liquid and gas have the same symmetries, and so there's no sharp distinction between them, which is why you can sneak around the phase transition. And the idea here is to find something called an order parameter. Don't worry, we'll say what that is, but to give you a taste, it's like the magnetization in a magnet. That's the order parameter for a magnet, is a net magnetization. And then based off of this order parameter, we will talk about what's called Landau's theory of phase transitions. So the order parameter ends up being a useful description for certain types of phase transitions. So van der Waals. Now, there's not too many empty boxes in your notes today, but maybe about every other slide has an empty box. So this is an empty box slide. There you go, the van der Waals equation of state. We derived this as a correction of the ideal gas law by correcting two assumptions that went into the ideal gas law. Two assumptions that went into it were that particles... Wow. No, there wasn't upstairs. Were that... Particles are of zero size. That was one of the assumptions. And we broke that assumption now and said, look, we're going to be a little bit more realistic. Particles really occupy a finite volume, so we'll correct the ideal gas law based on that. Also, we assumed that there were no interactions between particles in the ideal gas law. So we correct that a little bit and include the van der Waals, the slight van der Waals attraction that particles feel when they're close to each other. That gave us the van der Waals equation of state. So here's my big fine print disclosure here and disclaimer about the van der Waals equation of state, which is that we didn't do a rigorous derivation of all of those things. We did a qualitative derivation of how the physics should be if you include these two types of effects. Nobody really derives this thing terribly carefully, okay? But anyway, this is just to be honest here, we did a qualitative derivation of how the physics should roughly go. Now, we're going to proceed to use it beyond its low-density approximation. Why is this okay? It turns out that the van der Waals equation of state is very useful for describing qualitatively what happens at a liquid-gas phase transition and capturing this critical point where the phase transition goes away. And it's good for illustrating some of the things that are going on in that transition. So we'll use it, okay? But it's not entirely a rigorous derivation, and it's not the kind of equation that's really going to get us all the numbers correct. So we'll get things correct like the phase transition, the fact that there's a phase transition, what it's qualitatively about, the fact that there's a critical point where the phase transition line goes away. But if we tried to use the van der Waals equation of state to calculate the actual numbers of this line, exactly where the line lays, it would be a little off. So it's not entirely correct, but it's a useful description. So here is our phase diagram for water. We have some solid, liquid, and gas, and then we have this region up here at high pressure and high temperature where we can't tell the difference between liquid and gas. What we're interested in today is this liquid-gas phase transition and also where it disappears, which is called a critical point. What we will see is that the right way to analyze this line is to look in the pressure-volume plane at what's going on, and we will use the van der Waals equation of state to draw out what's called isotherms in the pressure-volume plane. So here, for example, is an isotherm all along this line. The van der Waals gas has the same temperature. And for a given volume change, it changes the pressure along this curve in that way. And what we'll see is that, so at very low volumes, that is when we've really squished the we've really squished the substance, it's liquid. And then as you increase the volume, we'll get a region here where we have a little bit of liquid, a little bit of gas in the container, and then eventually the liquid gets converted entirely to gas, and you continue along the isotherm. So there's this region in the middle of this dome where the isotherms will go completely flat. I think there must have been a little bit of tilt here to my drawing, because I see bad lack of anti-aliasing in my font here, but this is supposed to be a straight line. Okay, it's a completely horizontal line where there's a bit of coexistence in this dome right here. And to the left of the dome, we'll have a liquid. To the right, we have a gas. In the middle, we have both. And above it, you can't tell the difference. Any questions so far? If pressure and volume are conjugate variables, is it okay to plot them like this? You can always count on the correct answer. But I guess the question is why? Why is it okay to plot them like this together? They're conjugate. I always say that you can control one but not the other. Is this a self-contradictory diagram?
We're controlling one. Okay. One is dependent and one is independent.
Okay, that's right. So here, for example, we'll take volume to be the independent variable and pressure to be the dependent variable. So that's the trick here. You set one, and then you find where you are on the curve. If you try to set both, you won't be able to do it. Are there any questions so far? All right. So if we take the van der Waals equation of state here and plot out the constant temperature curves, what we want to do is go to a particular temperature. Okay, so this would be a high temperature curve. And then plot out what the pressure looks like as a function of volume. And at very high temperatures, it's going to be a more or less smooth behavior. At lower temperatures, we'll see that there's a bit of an inflection here. And all you do is take this equation and change the temperature from high temperature to low temperature. So sometimes you get this little uptick here. And there's one place where the kink's kind of gone away as a function of temperature. So as I raise the temperature, the kink goes away. And there's an inflection point. That's going to turn out to be the critical point. But it turns out that this region here where there's the upturn is unphysical. There's a reason why this just can't happen. And this little upturn, the kink, will lead to what's called phase separation. That is, the system can't be homogeneous anymore. It will separate itself into a part that's liquid and a part that's gas in this region here. So this is actually ends up being forbidden, and we'll see why. The reason is that the slope here, okay, you can't have a positive slope for pressure versus volume. If these were actually true and the system remained homogeneous and one phase throughout, then dp by dv at constant temperature, these are isotherms, so at constant temperature, this would be positive, and this turns out to not be allowed. So the reason is that let's say that I had a substance, this is some fictional substance here, that actually had this property, that dp by dv at constant temperature was greater than zero. Then if I put the substance into a balloon, and let me have a box here that has some ideal gas on the outside, we're going to have the van der Waal gas in the middle, well, something, some fictional substance that has this property, dp by dv at constant temperature is positive. Now, think about what might happen. The box is going to be rigid. So I have a rigid box, gas in the box, inside the balloon is some fictional substance. If this were true, if dp by dv were greater than zero, then if I increase the volume, if I increase the volume of the fictional substance a little bit, its pressure will increase. So I take the balloon, I artificially increase the volume of the balloon a little bit. That would cause the pressure inside the fictional substance to go up, which would push the balloon more, which would cause its pressure to go up, which would push the balloon more and cause its pressure to go up. So you get this cascade where the balloon would expand indefinitely, and which is an explosion, basically. So this fictional substance is explosive and not stable. So you can't have this. You can't have dp by dv at constant temperature be greater than zero. Not allowed. So this region here where the slope was positive is forbidden, because this would be the region of explosions. Yet, we don't see that happen, right? We don't see in a solid and a liquid to gas transition things just blowing up like that. So what we need to do is figure out what's really going on here in this potential explosive region. But that sounded good. Sorry, the mic just fell. So the system, it will turn out, doesn't actually take this path, because as we said, it's forbidden. So the system's going to find another path. What we'll see is that here in the middle, it's going to phase separate. It'll be partly liquid, partly gas, and that will be a more stable state energetically than this positive slope forbidden region. So what we want to do is approach this forbidden region from both sides. Let me take this one isotherm here, which should have gone through this forbidden region. I'm going to march along the isotherm from both directions. And what I want to look for is, where are the chemical potentials equal? Because if I have two phases in contact with each other, they have to have the same pressure, the same temperature, and the same chemical potential. So I will look for where they have the same chemical potential along here. And that's going to lead to having the same Gibbs free energies. Do you remember why that's the same thing? Yeah, because the Gibbs free energy is mu times N. Yeah, that's it. So same chemical potential means same Gibbs free energy. So there's a way to do this, which is called the Maxwell construction, where we're looking for the place on this isotherm and the place on this isotherm where the chemical potentials are equal. And remember how the Gibbs free energy goes. dG is minus sigma d tau plus vdP plus mu dN. Now I'm at an isotherm, so d tau is 0. I'm not going to let the number of particles in the gas change, so dN is also 0. So I'm really looking for dG is vdP in this graph here. And then I want to go to the place where the difference between the Gibbs free energies is 0. So I want Gibbs free energy of the liquid minus Gibbs free energy of the gas is integrate dG from gas to liquid, which is integrate vdP. I need that to be 0. Now, integrals can be interpreted in terms of areas. And what we're looking for, when we find this line, we will have that the two Gibbs free energies equal each other. That'll be the region where phase coexistence is possible. And the areas, we want integrate vdP. You're used to areas in terms of this. You're used to f of sigma. Man, it's getting annoying. So we're used to some function f of x can wiggle however you want. And then the integral f of x dx between two points, x1 and x2, 1, 2, is the area under the curve. You take the entire area under the curve. So I have integrate vdP, which means I need pressure as the x direction. So what you have to do is take this diagram here and turn your head sideways. So what we really mean is take pressure versus volume, but plot instead volume versus pressure. Let's see if I can get this right. It's going to go like that. All right. And I'm looking for equal areas. Pardon?
That's not a function. How can you take an integral?
Well, I have to break it up. So I can break it up, for example, let's say that this is going to end up being the correct line. So what I do is I take an integral from here to this inflection point here, in which case I'm grabbing this entire area. Then I'm going to take, where's the green marker? There we go. Then I'm going to take an integral from here through here and capture this volume here. Notice that will be a negative contribution because I'm coming backwards. Then I'll take an integral from here to here. So you see what happened was that this region here will get caught twice and cancel. This region here will get caught twice and cancel. This region is left over, and this region is left over. this one makes a positive contribution, this green, so red is positive contribution, green is negative contribution. I'm looking for these guys to cancel. That's the Maxwell construction. So here, looking for these areas to cancel. So, equal areas on that diagram translates into this area here needs to equal that area. And that's good because at the end of the day, that's going to be a straight line. And the straight line has to have temperature, pressure, and chemical potential equal. So we sort of knew at the outset it needed to be a straight line because all the straight lines have constant pressure along them. So it's got to be a straight line. We're on isotherms. The temperature is guaranteed to be the same. What we're doing is we're setting, well, where does that horizontal line go? And the chemical potential, having the two chemical potentials equal, will set now where the line sits. Does that make sense? Any questions so far? Okay, so these are the areas. Again, you have to turn your head sideways to see how the integrals work out. So the real answer will be, take these isotherms, and there'll be some region here, some upside down dome, where you have both liquid and gas. And as you move along this line, the percentage of each will change. So here it's liquid. I'm at cold enough temperature that it's liquid, and then I enter the coexistence region by increasing the volume, and then I get a little bit of gas at the top of the container. And then as I increase the volume more, the gas will take over until it's entirely gas by the time I exit over here. I'm going to continue along the isotherm. But all in there, the pressure is the same, the temperature is the same, the chemical potential is the same because I have two phases in coexistence. That's the Maxwell construction. Any questions? We call this thing at the top the critical point because that's the one point where everything became smooth. And beyond the critical point, you can't tell the difference between liquid and gas. You can always sneak around the liquid-gas phase transition, in this case by going to high enough pressure, for example. You can sneak around it. Any questions about that stuff? We used our usual conditions, the usual phase coexistence conditions. So two phases in contact are that the chemical potential, the pressure, and the temperature have to be equal. Now I want to move on to solids. What I want to think about is general ways to define phases and to categorize phases and say that this phase is different from the other phase. The reason this liquid-gas transition doesn't always happen is because liquid has no formal distinction from a gas. If I take a time average photo of a liquid, all the molecules are moving around each other and it'll look like one smear. If I take a time average photo of a gas, it looks just the same. I can't tell the difference based on what we'll see is called symmetry distinctions. A solid, and I remember to bring the squishy crystal, solid is a regular arrangement of atoms. Here I have a regular arrangement of atoms, or in this case, red bulb, which brings, but each atom is a particular distance from the other atom, and if I continue the crystal in all three directions, I'll see that there's a periodicity in the z direction, there's a periodicity in the y direction, and there's a periodicity in the x direction. So there's just a regular arrangement that makes it a solid. And the particular macroscopic formation of these guys, it tells you a little bit about quantum mechanics. I have, for example, a squishy crystal here where all the chemical bonds come up at right angles to each other. So if you saw a substance that grew in this kind of crystalline way, and you found it in nature, its crystals would look like cubes because the underlying chemical bond structure is all at 90 degrees to each other. Some crystals aren't this structure. In fact, most aren't. Some of them have hexagonal patterns in the bonds. So some of them, rather than forming all bonds at 90 degrees to each other, will form three bonds in a plane, for example. So, and those will all be equidistant from each other. Those kinds of substances form hexagonal type crystals. Somebody remind me during the break to go get my rock samples and bring them up and show you. So when you see crystals that grew naturally and they have a different, they have a particular shape to them, that tells you about the angles of the chemical bonds. So the actual crystal structure that pops out is a macroscopic manifestation of the quantum mechanics. So, you know, next time you're in one of these crystal shops and they're trying to tell you that amethyst is going to bring healing. Yeah, well, anyway. Don't think so. I will say that amethyst crystals make me happy. I like crystals. So, they. That's why I have a lot of them sitting on my desk. But I like them because of this. I like them because the shape of them and the color of them is directly due to quantum mechanics. So, these quantum mechanical properties will tell you about the faceting of the crystal, which is what I mean by the shape of the crystal as it grows. It gives you rigidity, the fact that they have a particular bounce back. If I push on a substance, it pushes back. And the color also is determined by those sort of properties. And despite the fact that I can make crystals out of a variety of substances, so many solids are this type of solid, they're a regular arrangement of atoms. Even though I can do this with a lot of different types of atoms and a lot of different types of chemistry, somehow they all end up being the same in that we can call them all solids, and we can call them all crystals. So there's something similar about all of them too. And it turns out that this is because many matters, that is, when you have several of one thing together, that ends up being a big deal. So let me tell you what I mean by that. Basically, all crystals will be rigid at the end of the day. They'll all be in the solid phase. It doesn't matter which atoms are making it. So there's some larger idea here that comes out. Anytime you have a crystal, it does bounce back when you push on it. And that's a larger idea than a particular constituent. And to really drive home this idea that many matters, let me tell you the distinction between true and useful. Now don't go screaming and running from the room yet, but I am going to make a distinction between ideas that are true and ideas that are useful. So, for example, I could try to build up this crystal here by simulating it entirely on a computer. So I could take 10 to the 23 atoms, put them all on a computer. What I'd have to do to properly solve the problem is say that each atom has a particular wave function with respect to the other atoms in the system. But then I need to allow for the fact that the atom could have a lot of different wave functions, not just its ground state, but it has an excited state, a next excited state, a third excited state, whole tower, an infinite tower of them. Let me cut it off, you know, at maybe 100 excited states or something. So if it takes, say, m to store each particle's wave function, so each particle has a wave function, and I'm going to say it takes m bits of memory to store it. If I have n particles, where n is, say, 10 to the 23, it's going to take me m to the n memory to solve the problem. That is, I need m bits of memory for every single atom I want to put in there. And remember, I need also a hierarchy of wave functions. There's not just one wave function. I need to remember which one I'm in. So it's going to take a few bits here to say that. And so if you try to solve a problem with m to the n degrees of freedom, where n is 10 to the 23, good luck. This is what we call a catastrophe of dimension. That is, if I tried to write this out as a matrix, I get a matrix, which is n to the 10 to the 23. So I can't fit that in a computer. There's only 10 to the 80 particles in the universe. So if you try to solve a problem that's got greater than 10 to the 80 dimensions, it's not even possible in principle to solve it in this universe, except by putting the actual substance together and letting nature do it for you. So ab initio calculations make a few approximations at the outset and use some experimental inputs to tell you some of the phenomenological parameters and keep going. But really, to solve the system properly, this is what you'd run into. You simply can't do it. So even though you might be able to write down a theory of everything, that is, I could write down all the quantum mechanics and all the electrostatics and all the thermodynamics and statistical mechanics that every atom needs to satisfy while it's trying to build this crystal, I could put all that in there. It would be correct. It would be simple, somewhat simple. There's only a few laws that they all need to satisfy, but it wouldn't tell me anything. Okay. I can write it down. I can think about it in principle, but I can't solve it. So it'd be true, but useless. Here's a great example of something that's true but useless. We all like Feynman, I hope. Feynman has what's called the unworldliness equation. This came up in his Feynman lectures. Has anybody encountered this yet? I'm sure you all, when you're done with your homework, you know, spending 12 hours thinking about physics, the first thing you want to do is go read more physics for fun. But Feynman is a good place to turn to when you just need some physics for fun. So he has in his lectures what's called the unworldliness equation. It's very clever. So let me take this quantity U. And what I want to incorporate into U is all the laws in the physical universe, absolutely everything. Everything that we know and don't know, but it's just all the laws that everything in the physical universe has to follow. The quantity U is going to be the violation between what the universe actually does and what its laws are. So that's the degree of violation of physical laws. And so that's the unworldliness, okay, or the unphysicalness of whatever you're observing. And Feynman's grand statement is, look, here's a theory of everything. U is zero. There is no unworldliness to any physical manifestation. It has to follow laws. U is zero. There you go. We just wrote down a theory of everything. We define this to include every physical law, both known and undiscovered. So it's complete. It's also correct. U is always zero. And it's completely useless. So this is an example of an equation that's true and useless. So I have the balloon here to remind me to tell a joke. Is anybody double majoring in math? Well, you'll have to forgive me later. Okay, so...
I'm sorry, what did you say?
I'm going to tell you a joke about mathematicians now.
Oh, okay.
Awesome.
So two physicists are in a hot air balloon, and being good physicists, they play with the controls because they've never been in a hot air balloon before, and they're experimenting with it. So they play with, you know, how hot air balloons work. You have a little valve where you can play with the flame, and you can heat up the air inside or cool off the air inside. And so they play with this, and when they heat up the air, they see that they float as they expected, and when they let the air cool down, they drift down as they expected. And you know how weather is layered, right? There's different directions to the wind at different heights. So by changing your height with a hot air balloon, you can go in a few different directions depending on how the winds are going that day. You can just change your height and catch different winds and go different places. So they play with this long enough to where they're completely lost. No idea where they are. So they're flying over a mountain. And say, oh, great. Look, there's somebody on top of the mountain. Let's go ask where we are. Okay, so they lower the balloon a little bit as they're passing the mountain, and as they're getting within earshot, they yell down and say, hey, where are we? And the guy on top of the mountain looks down, looks at his feet, kind of scribbles in the ground, and takes a long time, okay? And eventually, just as the physicists are passing over and getting a little worried here, they're not going to get an answer, when they're almost out of earshot, the guy looks up and yells, you're in a hot air balloon! And the balloon drifts off. So one physicist says to the other physicist, that was a mathematician. Oh, really? How do you know? Well, it took a long time to answer. Everything he said was correct, and it told us absolutely nothing. So it was true, but not useful. With apologies to mathematicians. Not everything that's true is useful. So what I'm getting at is that sometimes descriptions of the universe, like I said, sometimes they're true but not useful. You can also find descriptions that are not entirely true but far more useful. We call those approximations, by the way. So approximations often get you a lot more mileage as far as having things that are useful. Did you guys break the pasta?
No, I still
don't have an M. Oh, that's far more exciting. So reductionism is this idea that everything is due to underlying microscopic laws. So physics progressed quite a bit through reductionist philosophy by trying to break things down into their little bitty constituents, which, of course, is quite a bit of fun, right? It basically means you can go into a lab, smash things to bits, and study the smaller parts and find things out. So this reductionist philosophy that I will understand better a substance if I pick it all apart and break it into its smallest constituents, and then I found atoms, and that told me a lot about the universe. And then if I take the atom and I smash it up into bits and look at its smallest parts. That told me about the electron, and it told me about the nucleus. And then I took the nucleus, and I broke it into little bitty tiny bits, and I found that it had neutrons and protons in it. And then I took the neutrons and protons and built really expensive machines and was able to find that there are quarks inside of those. And so we keep thinking, well, how far does it go? We keep on going down and down and down and down. So there's this idea that gave us a lot of mileage for a while, which is that I'll learn a lot of stuff if I take everything and break it into the smallest pieces possible. So if I understand the smallest pieces, then I'll understand. See, if I understand the building blocks, then I can build things back up again. And I'll understand the larger structure by understanding the building blocks. This is reductionism. It's a philosophy. It tells you a particular direction to think about that can help you learn more stuff. And we did get a lot of mileage out of it. But we got the idea, again, from philosophy. It's from Greek philosophy. It's not an empirically tested or verified idea. It's a philosophy. So it turns out that there's cutting-edge science now progressing by throwing this idea out entirely, by saying, you know what, we got some mileage out of that, but now let's look at things in a different way. Sometimes you can't learn everything by breaking everything into its smallest bits. So here's an example. I'm going to build a building, and I'm going to build one out of brick, and I'm going to build one out of slightly larger brick, and I'm going to build some others out of these kinds of concrete things, not actually the usual clay brick material, but concrete, larger brick material. And I'm going to build some structures out of wood, but at the end of the day, they're all going to be houses. So it's possible to get large-scale behavior that's basically the same. You don't care whether this building is built out of brick or concrete blocks or wood, as long as it stays standing. And, well, you might care about the wood part if a tornado hit it. But let's say it's a nice, stable structure. We'll build it out of steel, okay? So steel, brick, or concrete blocks. You don't really care as long as the building's going to be functional. And you can get the same functionality out of the building with different materials up to a point. I have lived in earthquake zones where they mix the two materials. In earthquake zones, what you really want to do is make sure that you have reinforced concrete. This is where you put steel bars through the concrete in two directions at least, usually three, and then you pour concrete around that. And so concrete, although it's pretty stable against compressional stress, that is, you won't break it by squishing it, you can break it by pulling on it. And so that's why people switch to reinforced concrete in places where you really need to protect against both kind of stresses, both compression and tension, because pulling on concrete can pull it apart, but it can't pull the steel apart. So there you go, reinforced concrete. If you live in an earthquake zone, get some reinforced concrete. But more or less, unless you care about earthquakes, your building is going to look the same. So although it's true that when I go down to these constituents and I start building everything back up, I can say, look, one particle plus one particle is two particles, great. Two and two is four, great, can keep building this up. But at some point, the more is going to give me something new that it turns out wasn't contained in the smaller particles, like a house. A house really wasn't contained in the smaller particles. The house wasn't really in the bricks. They used the bricks to build the house, but then the house ended up being independent of whether they used bricks or concrete or reinforced concrete. So turns out we need to learn a lot more about this part and, okay? So we've broken things apart to where we understand the little bits, but the adding them together turns out to have a few more subtleties to it. So here's another example of why reductionism is false. That is, it doesn't always tell you things that are helpful. This is my cat, Marshmallow. Welcome to Marshmallow. She likes to hide in bags. She likes to sit in the sink. And this is her favorite place to sleep on the couch. So she's furry, as you can tell. That's actually quite a bit of fur. I'm really glad summer's over because she was shedding quite a bit. She's got like a spare cat right there in her tail. So I can ask the question, why does she have fur? Your choices are A, because she's Marshmallow, B, because she's a cat, C, because she's a mammal. So if I say that she has fur because she's Marshmallow, why does my pet have fur? Well, because she's Marshmallow. Well, that's true, Marshmallow has fur, but it's not true that she has fur because she's Marshmallow. That's over-specific, because she's one in a larger set. She's a cat, and so the larger set of cats have fur, except for that one strain of cat that they bred to have a lot of fur. Let's leave those out of this discussion. There are some hairless varieties out there. But the reason she has fur is because she's a cat. And then I could make that even larger, and I could say, well, Maybe I should say she has fur because she's a mammal. Well, that's not quite correct, because there are plenty of mammals out there that don't have fur. We're mammals, we have hair. We wouldn't quite, so I have hair on the back of my hand, you can't see it, I wouldn't really call that fur. So let's stick with the fur thing. And then the right logical dependence to say here is, why does my pet have fur? It's because she's a cat. Do you see how identifying it as the fact that she's marshmallow is over-specific and doesn't actually tell me the logical flow? So in the same way, if I take a crystal, take a solid, and I say, well, okay, let's say that I had a crystal made up of aluminum atoms. I say, well, why is the solid rigid? And if I say it's because it's made of aluminum, that's not actually correct. It is true that a crystal made of aluminum will be rigid, but a crystal made of anything will be rigid. So the right answer is going to be a larger physical principle. And the larger physical principle doesn't present itself until you get enough particles around to notice the larger law. So what I'm arguing is that there are fundamental physical laws in nature that you can't discover or talk about until you get enough particles around to notice them. And they're still fundamental laws, but they're laws about larger collective behavior. So I'm going to leave you to chew on that over the break. Let's take a 10-minute break, come back at 2:25, and I'm going to go get my rocks. You can play with the crystal. There's return homeworks over there if anyone wants return homeworks.
In principle, you could compute the wave functions of a large number of particles. Wouldn't those physical laws come out?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So it's not untrue that that doesn't work.
It actually doesn't tell you why the larger particles come out.
No.
That's actually what I'm getting at. So it could work. It's actually
it's
in practice, you can't make it work.
Ever.
It could work in principle, but not in practice, and then it's actually not useful. It still doesn't actually tell you why things happen. So for physicists, we're interested in why things happen. And I want to know the largest logical set of assumptions that makes something happen. So, definition is
false.
I'm being extremist when I say that, but.
Real quick.
Yeah.
I completely got the point.
Okay.
But is this equation backwards?
Where?
Should it not be m to the m?
Yeah.
And I'm just thinking because of this. If it was m to the n, and you only used the ground state, that would mean there would only be one bit of memory needed. But really, it would need at least as many as particles you have to how many states they have.
Well, actually, so what
all
I want to
those states are incorporated in the m.
But what I'm saying is, if your particle only had one state, then this m to the n, no matter how big n was, would still only be that. So you would be able to simulate as many particles as you want.
Okay, so what I
need. Because one to any power is one.
That's right. So I see. So you're saying that if this was one, if m was one.
Right.
But I don't actually need that. I need more memory than that to store the wave function, because the actual wave function could be one of 100.
Right.
So I need a few bits there to encode that. There's 3 or 4, something like that.
I was just thinking, should it be n to the m?
It's supposed to be m to the n because. So I'm going to take n. I'm going to take n. N wave functions. We'll see. Here's my grid. Okay. And for each particle, so there's n of these boxes. And each particle has n. And for this particle, I have n. These aren't the same.
Right.
But I have to use this much memory to store that state.
So I don't
So the question is actually the amount of memory that takes, it takes m.
Each time you need less
I'd rather maybe for you just put it low. You would maybe longer and
Newton's theory, which is like, okay, they're always in the blue.
Oh, he's back here. So it'd be like, okay,
plus both are
fine.
Yeah.
Talk to your manager. Yeah. You talk to Sandy from my
He was kind of interested
yeah,
in talking
I've been to
the
point where like,
yeah,
when you see my head role advisor, unless it's
so you
like
you
came
to
advise about internships or where to go anything like that, it's more physics involved stuff.
The main point was
like,
the
okay,
not that
what do I need for this?
You provide a resignation. It doesn't matter what it is.
What happens here? So
the DC client has
to
match
up.
Yeah.
The
AC can be
one to make sure I'm on track.
Once you got
there,
the minute you want
to
do is charge that as an
to make sure I have the requirements. So I can graduate.
That's what we're going to discuss. Actually, what we're going to discuss on Thursday is more. Now that I've given that idea, but now we have to kind of figure out how to solve the problem. Now the problem, we were saying the problem is not going to be independent of anything. So from there we basically we'll try to standardize how to solve the problem. First day one for our email. He was kind of interested in that. First time I've seen him excited.
So,
yeah.
I'm sure I'm trying to work this stuff all out. I don't even know what to do.
He was actually a double E class on application learning how to use Word and Canvas.
One thing to notice, very important, is the part where he says that the if our vector function and the magnitude of that vector function is constant,
it's basically you just giving out
the magnitude of the function is constant, then you can plot
out
the derivative. What do you get?
That's true. Makes sense. Why will this form into a big cube? I know it will, like, because pyrite does it.
I don't have a big cube of pyrite.
Because shouldn't one side of the crystal like be what it? How many particles it adds be independent of what's going on the other side?
Wait, the number doesn't matter. What tends to happen is that there's a different surface energy. to the different ways you can cut a crystal, and the same thing about how they grow. So it turns out if I tried to grow this crystal more, it would tend to, you know, let's say that I had a whole bunch of this two-layer thing. Then when I add more atoms, they'll go to the next layer. But then it turns out that rather than building on top of that atom, that's a bit unstable. The next best thing to do is to build on the layer.
Okay.
And so you tend to actually complete a layer.
Yeah. But it's kind of weird
before you go to the next one. Usually. If you raise the temperature enough, that's not quite correct.
Well, yeah, but like it's funny how it goes. Like a cube will be the same length on each side.
That's I see. The actual whole cube.
You know what I mean? Like, it'll grow the same height as the length.
I don't remember.
Oh, no.
I don't feel terrible.
I'm going to find out later.
What'll happen, it depends how you're growing the cube. So if you're growing the cube in an environment where all surfaces are available. So if all surfaces have the same environment, the same pressure, temperature, humidity, concentration of other stuff outside of them, then all the atoms will tend to congregate with the same probability. So on average, you should get a cube. Not a perfect cube, but roughly a cube. Whereas if I had some preference when I had this crystal open to adding atoms to the side versus adding atoms to the top, then I would grow. So think of it in terms of probabilities.
So this is the difference between sugar and salt, isn't it?
Which one?
Well, sugar and salt, I forget which is which, but one of them is always cubes.
They're tasteless.
And the other one is...
Salt is cubes.
Yeah, and the sugar is kind of just randomish.
It's just crystal.
Crystal, so salt actually has a proper
structure.
It's sodium and chloride, and so in this kind of structure, every other atom would be salt and every other one would be chloride. So it's kind of checkered pattern. It's a real proper cube. And sugar is just more complicated. I don't have to know what shape crystal is.
You're going to die one day.
Sugar's not a crystal.
Sugar grows as a crystal.
Is it?
Yeah. Have you ever had that sugar candy where they,
Rock
candy. Rock candy.
Oh, yeah.
Rock candy. That's crystallized sugar. I don't remember what shape it is.
It hurts my mouth.
Sugar's a...
It's sharp.
Sugar's
it's
a
sharp, no?
Sugar's a big hexagon of carbon.
She's an Asian version of crystallized sugar. I feel really bad. I do not remember the shape of a sugar molecule. It's a hexagon. So then it's cube, but it's...
There's six carbons, right? So it's...
I think it might be just a chain. I feel so ignorant. So why is that chemistry?
I didn't.
Where's my husband? I know, really. Do we have any chemistry majors? Anybody a chemistry major?
Kyle's chemistry man.
Does that count?
Or do we have the best
one? Yeah,
I had a question on the.
I can make stuff up.
If you have M memory for N particles,
right?
For each particle, shouldn't it be
M? Is that what you were talking about?
No.
Memory? It should be M for each particle.
Right, so
M times M times M
plus M plus M plus M plus M plus M.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I see what you're saying. Okay, so here's my little bit of it. So I have N boxes, and then I have M that I need to store for each one of them. And I see what you're saying, that I could have thought it was M plus M plus M plus M. But what I really need for M is I need a variety. What I mean is that there are M different wave functions that it could have. It could be in its ground state, its excited state, its next excited state. So think of M as that number of different wave functions it could have had. So what I really need is I need to take these M possibilities times these other M possibilities, because it could be in any of those.
But the other M possibilities is for the other particles.
Mm-hmm.
But they might affect each other.
Right, they do.
Okay.
It's still huge.
Don't question.
No, it is.
Yeah, so maybe I should think of it as M waves for the first particle, M waves for the second particle, M waves for the third particle, and so on. We should get started again. Now that somebody's left the room. Come back.
It should be M to N.
Supposedly from the experts, that's...
This is sucrose.
Good.
This is
good.
Glucose,
and that by itself will be fine, so it is a ring. So it should form some sort of hexagonal crystal. So somebody go get us some sugar candy. Some crystallized sugar candy. So I have here some rocks to pass around. I'm sorry, I don't remember all the names of all the rocks, but this is quartz. And this is one of my favorites because I grew up in Alabama and I could find quartz crystals in my backyard. That was really fun. Never this pretty. This is not one that I found. They were usually cloudy and not this nice looking. But if you look from the top, you can see that the basic crystal structure is hexagonal. That means that the molecules are grabbing onto each other in a hexagonal pattern. So that the actual shape of the crystal tells you something about the underlying chemical bond structure. And this is also quartz. You notice they have different colors. This is sold as amethyst. This is sold as quartz. It's the same chemical structure. They're both silicon dioxide. Silicon dioxide is what glass is made of. So sand is made of and glass is made of. So if I take sand and I grind it up and melt it and put it together, I can get glass. If I cooled it slowly enough, I could get it to form a crystal. So this is made of the same stuff as the glass, but the glass over there is amorphous. It's what we call an amorphous solid. That is, the silicon dioxide is not in a regular pattern. It's random. That's why glass actually flows a little bit over time. If you go to some really old building, which is kind of hard to find in the United States. If you go to Europe, you go to some really, really old building, and it's got glass in it, the glass is usually thicker at the bottom because it's amorphous and flows a little bit, whereas the crystal won't do that. These atoms in here are in a regular array. And this is the same crystal structure. What's different and made this one, I'll pass these around, what I want you to notice is the hexagonal shape. And this one's purple, but it's also silicon dioxide. It has an impurity in it. It's either manganese or iron will turn it purple. And what's going on is that the color of a substance has to do with how the photons interact with the electrons inside. And when I change out one of the atoms inside, so if I'm substituting in some manganese impurities in here, for example, that changes the electronic levels just a little bit. And the change in the electronic levels actually gives it a different color. So whereas the silicon dioxide was clear, meaning for optical wavelengths, it's really not interacting. It's more or less just going straight through. This one interacts with some of the visible wavelengths and produces a purple color. And this guy is the one that, unfortunately, I forgot what it is. But we know it's not quartz because it doesn't have the quartz structure to it. And if you look closely at its surface, this is great because it looks a little bit like the Death Star if it weren't, you know, if the Death Star hadn't been spherical. And it's tending to form nice right angles, but lots of really great facets on this guy. And so that tells you a little bit about how the chemical structure is forming up there. This is hematite. So this one's nice and dense because it's made mostly of iron. And what you'll notice in this one is that the crystals are forming in sheets. What that means is that there's a preference. The chemical bonding is stronger in the plane than it is between layers. So when these guys are forming, so if I use this as an example, when the layers are forming, as an atom comes in and wants to settle on one of these facets as the crystal's growing, when you see this kind of plate structure like that, it means that the chemical bonds that would grow this way are stronger than the chemical bonds that would grow this way, which means that this is a much lower energy state. That's what stronger means. So an atom coming in has higher probability of landing over here because of the energetics and sticking there. So that's how you grow flat crystals. So pass that guy around too. What I want you to notice is the crystal shape. And the crystal shape tells you something about the underlying chemical, the shape of the underlying chemical bonding. Does anybody have any questions about that? All right. So despite all of those crystals I'm handing out being made from different substances and they have different faceting to them, they have some similar properties in that they're hard, for example. They're rigid, and when I push on them, they push back. They don't move and squish about. And I forgot to tell you one more difference between the crystallized form of silicon dioxide and the amorphous form of silicon dioxide. I'm going to make the custodians mad here. Touch the window. I just left that finger on it. Windows, when I touch them, usually the environment around you is at a lower temperature than your body temperature, otherwise it would be uncomfortable, right? So the window's at a lower temperature. I can feel like it feels cold. Part of the reason I feel it's cold is because when I touch it, heat transfers from me into the glass. But the glass, since it's amorphous, doesn't carry heat very quickly. It turns out that heat is carried better by phonon waves. We've talked about phonon waves a little bit before. Those are the regular waves that can happen in a crystalline structure. And these crystallized bits of silicon dioxide, the quartz, since they're crystalline and have that nice phonon structure available to them, they transport heat much more efficiently than glass does. So one of the ways you can tell if something's quartz versus glass, even though it's all silicon dioxide, is the quartz will feel a little bit colder when you touch it. So they're at the same ambient temperature, more or less, okay? But the quartz will carry the heat away more efficiently, so the quartz will actually feel colder when you touch it. And that's because the crystal forms better phonon structures than the amorphous solid. So sound modes in a crystal. We've talked about sound modes before. Sound is vibrations of things. And in a crystal, the vibrations are regular, and we call them phonons. So here's one phonon mode, for example. I squish the thing, or I can look, for example, if I wiggle it like this, there's a particular frequency to that. And this is this would be more of a long wavelength phonon. Let's see if I can get this going. I want to try to get the middle moving opposite to the top. That's what I'm doing here. I have the middle moving opposite to the top. It's a faster mode. So this has a shorter wavelength because the top is moving opposite to the next layer. So smaller wavelengths are higher frequencies in a crystal. So based, though, on just a few things, I can tell you about the energy structure of the phonons in any crystal. You don't have to tell me what the crystal is made of. You don't have to tell me what kind of chemical bonds it forms. If you just tell me how many dimensions are in your universe, how many dimensions of space, usually that's going to be three, how many atoms there are per unit cell. So here, for example, my squishy crystal has one atom per unit cell. That is, it's only got one constituent. The silicon dioxide would have at least three atoms per unit cell. If you tell me that, and the reason for that is that unit cell means what's the basic repeated structure. Here, the basic repeated structure is one atom. For silicon dioxide, the basic repeated structure is silicon dioxide. So I have to draw a box around all three of those atoms and repeat that, and then I get the crystal. So if you tell me the dimension and how many atoms are in the unit cell, I can tell you quite a bit about the energy structure of the phonons. And I don't need to know what it's made of. I don't need to know whether you used aluminum or iron or whatever. I just need to know a few facts, and I can tell you quite a bit about the phonon spectrum. I can tell you that one of the low-energy phonon modes is going to be the longitudinal mode. Two of them will be transverse. That's just based on dimension. And then based on the number of atoms in the unit cell, I can tell you how many phonon bands are there. If I have a lot of atoms in a unit cell, so let me say that I have two atoms in a unit cell, for example. One of the modes is for them to wiggle back and forth like this really fast. And that's a high energy. Turns out that that's a completely distinct mode from the kind where the two atoms move together, which is the lower energy modes. And there's actually a gap in the energies between those two types of modes. That is, this kind is way, way higher energy than the other kind where they move together. And so that actually, the number of atoms in the unit cells tells you the number of different distortions the unit cell can have with respect to itself, which will tell you the number of phonon bands that you can have. So it's all of this information I can tell you that's independent of the particular types. Let me remind you what longitudinal and transverse means. So if I have a phonon that's traveling in that direction and the atoms are getting compressed along that direction as well, so if they're whacking into each other like this and transferring that way, that's a longitudinal mode. It means the movement is along the phonon direction. If it's a transverse mode, that means the atoms are displacing this way, transverse the direction in which the wave is traveling. So if it's kind of that kind of wave, that's a transverse wave. And that's just a question of dimension. There's always one longitudinal mode, where the distortion is along the direction the wave is traveling. Then all the other dimensions that are left over contribute to these transverse modes. So we have three space dimensions. So I have a transverse mode that goes up and down this way while the wave is traveling that way. I have a transverse mode that goes this way while the wave is traveling that way. If I had other space dimensions, I'd have other transverse modes. So just a few facts, and I can tell you a lot about how phonons look in various materials. And it's independent of the microscopic. It doesn't matter which atoms are there. It's not even specific to Coulomb interactions. Okay? So if I change the universe, which I can't do, but if I did, and I change the Coulomb interaction into a different form, a different shape for the potential, I would still get these properties out. If I formed a crystal, I'd still have a phonon structure that had these general principles in it, that there's one longitudinal and two transverse modes. there's a certain number of higher energy bands due to the number of atoms in the unit cell. So I'd get the same answer. What that means is these general principles about the phonon spectrum aren't due to microscopics. They aren't due to the actual broken apart small laws. It's not something that really comes out of a reductionist philosophy. It's due to a higher organizing principle, which simply says, you know what, any crystal will do this. As long as it's organized into a crystal, I know the phonon spectrum. Does that make sense? Okay. What this means is that there's some sort of larger idea at stake here. We call this emergence. When a whole collection of particles together has some new behavior that's a higher organizing principle, there's a new overriding law not contained in the smaller laws, even though you can build it up from the smaller laws. It's a new law because it's not due to the smaller laws. Because I can change the smaller laws and still get the larger law. So there's something bigger going on. So if I get the same macroscopic behavior independent of microscopic details, that means the big stuff wasn't due to the small stuff. That means that reductionism didn't tell you a whole lot in that case. Any questions so far? Who's got the rocks? Keep passing the rocks around. All right. You've actually seen examples of emergence. Emergence is when a lot of constituents together have collective behavior that's different from the individual particles, that's new, and that you won't notice when you only have one of the particles or two of the particles. So here's an example of emergence. The wave in a baseball stadium, or we've done the wave in this class. And the wave, as it travels along a sea of people, a crowd of people, is a distinct phenomenon in and of itself. If I tried to demonstrate the wave just with myself, it would look pretty lame. And it wouldn't really be a wave. The wave has to be something that several people do together. What was that?
Let's see.
Yeah, well, it's like that. There you go. It wasn't very exciting. So you need a lot of people together to make the wave happen. And other things that pop out of many people interacting are governments, for example. If you were an alien and you had only met one person in your life, would you predict governments and political parties and monarchies and republics and things like that? Would you predict economies? Economies are interactions among many different things. So these properties, the wave in a baseball stadium, the fact that governments exist, the fact that people feel the need to buy and sell and they create economies, those things that happen on a larger scale are independent of who's doing it. All of this stuff works no matter what team you root for, or the governments and economies happen no matter what continent you're on. Independent of race, independent of religious background, height, any of this stuff is independent of the fact that people together will form economies and governments. So there are emergent things that happen in collections of several particles together. They're new. You can't even notice them until you get a lot of the constituent together, so that you get some sort of collective effect and laws that emerge out of the system of many things. And one of the great ideas that helped guide us through this mess a little bit, this fact that when you put many particles together, you can get new laws. You know, how do you go about describing the new laws and finding the new laws? You use symmetry, and Emmy Noether taught us that. Emmy Noether was a famous mathematician last century, and she gave us this idea that symmetries lead to conservation laws. So the idea is take your system of many particles, like the crystal, and figure out what kinds of symmetries it obeys. Then you know what kinds of conservation laws it obeys. And then you can learn quite a bit about the collection of particles together, just based on symmetries. So in fact, a lot of the stuff that you learned in high school and in freshman physics really is based on Noether's theorem. So you know about energy conservation. You know about momentum conservation. You know about angular momentum conservation. All of these conservation laws came out of symmetries. They only work when you have the underlying symmetries there. So, for example, let's see. The easiest one to get a handle on is momentum conservation. Momentum conservation happens anytime you have space translation invariance. So what I mean by that is take whatever system you're looking at and translate it a little bit in space. And if you have a system that's completely spatially translationally invariant, that means I can translate it by any amount at all, from epsilon to 10 whatever units, okay? You can translate it however much you want, and it looks the same. That's a system where you'll get momentum conservation. So, for example, if we had an ice skater, if we convert the room here to ice and set out an ice skater, let me assume that the ice skater has no friction with respect to the ice, and you tap the ice skater and they start moving, they should, according to momentum conservation, just continue forever as long as it's a big plane of ice. And that will be true as long as the ice is translationally invariant. But what happens if I put a mountain in the middle? Let me put a nice little rounded hill of ice in the middle, and I push the ice skater towards the mountain. What's going to happen? Is the momentum constant? No, there's something wrong with this, right? What will happen is that as the ice skater approaches the hill, the linear momentum will change a little bit. And what happened there was that now your ice is not translationally invariant. It has a feature, it has a mountain. And when I translate the mountain, I would notice. When I translate the mountain, I would notice. So momentum conservation doesn't happen in that system. You needed complete spatial translational invariance to get momentum conservation. Have you heard this before? My guess is probably no.
Yeah.
You have heard it before. Where? Good. So every time you see a conservation law, there was a symmetry underneath it that gave rise to it. Energy conservation comes from time translation invariance. The fact that, yeah, question.
So is that why light moves slower in a gravitational curve? Like, is it slow? Like, when you have a big gravitational field?
You might be right. We need to sort out some ideas here, which is that as soon as I put a gravitational wall somewhere, I've broken the spatial translational invariance.
Yeah.
So, on the other hand, the photon is constrained to move in the space that it's in. But then again, that space is not translationally invariant because it has a feature in it. It has a curvature to it. So I'm not entirely sure. I mean, we know that it's going to curve along its own space, and it's going to do that. I think let's chalk that one up to space curving. Okay? Because I'm not sure, but I think what you want to do is you want to say, well, let's put the really massive object here, and then let's measure through it. You know, let's say the photon is going to travel right through and not interact with the matter. It just goes straight through the gravitational well and come out the other side. Since it gets diverted by the fact that there's curved space it has to go through before it comes out the other side, if I measured it that way, I would find that its apparent linear momentum had changed.
Yeah.
So you could think of it that way.
Yeah.
On the other hand, its real linear momentum went through the actual space. And the actual space was curved. So I think it depends on how you want to parse that one. Any other comments, questions? Okay. So energy conservation comes out of time translation invariance. Okay, what do I mean by that? So you get taught that physical laws are the same everywhere and at all times. So first of all, your physical laws don't change as a function of time. But if I have a system where I'm changing things as a function of time, then I won't have energy conservation. So let's see, what's an example of that? Here we go. Here, I'm going to take my crystal here, and I'm going to do something to it as a function of time. Move it up and down. So its potential energy changes as a function of time. And it's because there's a potential under it, my hand, that's changing as a function of time. So unless the system itself is time translation invariant, then I just said that. Too many negatives. The system needs to be time translation invariant to have energy conservation. Otherwise, if there's some time-varying potential I'm adding to it, then I change the energy as a function of time. Just the way it goes. Okay. Rotational invariance. You need that for angular momentum conservation. Question?
What do you mean by time-translational effect on
physics? Well, what I mean is that the system and its conditions, its external conditions, are the same as a function of time at any time snapshot I look at. So in the example of raising and lowering the crystal, I'm changing its gravitational potential as a function of time. So I'm changing its total energy as a function of time.
But in that motion, when you go up or down, the total energy of the system doesn't change.
If you include my hand in the system, yes. If I just look at the energy of the crystal, by moving it up, I actually changed its potential energy. And then by moving it down, I changed its potential energy again.
So in that case, you're saying that the energy is not conserved? Or?
The energy of just the crystal is not conserved, because I'm changing the conditions of the crystal as a function of time. Yeah. So, make sense? Yeah.
Well, based on the first two invariances here, I'm just wondering if we can make that a general principle that the relationship between the invariance and the conservation leads to an uncertainty principle. Because we have energy, time, space,
and
momentum. Is that true for all of them?
I don't think that's related.
Okay. That's just coincidence, then.
I'm gonna have to think that one through.
So
do
you get variable?
But let me tell you my understanding of where uncertainty principles come from, quantum mechanically. So we have, in thermodynamics, conjugate variables, where you can't determine both. You determine one or the other, right? You use one as the independent variable and one as the dependent variable. In quantum mechanics, when you have conjugate variables mean that they don't commute. X with P, for example, gave you I, H bar. I'm going to set each bar to 1 because it doesn't matter what I'm saying. Mm-hmm. Anytime you have two variables, when you try to commute them, they give you an I, then you have an uncertainty principle. So if that ever comes up in your structure, and it comes up in various cases, there's actually, in superconductors, we get a similar thing that pops up, which is that in a superconductor, or any superfluid actually, there's a wave function that's associated with all the bosons haven't gone into the ground state. If I take the phase of the wave function, psi equals some absolute value, e to the I theta is a psi, and then I take the number of particles that are participating in the condensate. So number in the condensate. Those actually don't commute. So those actually have an uncertainty principle associated with them. So anytime you have quantum mechanically conjugate variables, you get this uncertainty principle. Greater than or approximately equal to I with factors of h bar and 2 running around. And there's no particular symmetry. Well, let's see. So in maybe there is. The generator here, I can say quantum mechanically that the generator of space translations is momentum. If I want to say that I want to translate something by a certain amount, x equals a, I can apply UVIP to it. There may be a relation there. I have to think about that. What up?
I mean, is there an uncertainty principle between rotational invariance and angular momentum conservation? That's one way to solve.
Right. And then I don't know. Have to look at that.
So we couldn't take temperature and entropy and say, oh, we have an uncertainty principle.
I think there is. I think you may be correct. Because one of the ways that I can represent P is minus I d by dx. I'm suppressing H bars. And one of the ways in quantum mechanics that I can represent angular momentum is d by d theta. Theta is an angle. Which means there is an uncertainty principle between the angle and the angular momentum. So you may have hit on something very, very deep. So for at least two cases, we can calculate here, works out. Yeah. Good. Nice connection. Okay. Any other comments? Questions? All right.
So how did he actually derive this kind of pressure? I mean, we just assume that this is true, right?
I'm telling you it's true. The proof is tough. Proof took a mathematician.
so we can get the same thing. We can express temperature as the differential and entropy.
Oh.
So we could get pressure and volume into the similar types of...
You know what? These are quantum mechanically conjugate variables, not thermodynamically conjugate.
Okay.
It's,
so I'm changing definitions of conjugate between subjects.
Well, we're talking about two different kinds of conjugate. We're talking about quantum mechanically conjugate is X with P doesn't commute, meaning, well, so why did we apply the label conjugate to both cases? So with X and P, since they don't commute, you can't simultaneously diagonalize them, which means you can't know the position and the momentum at the same time. They can't, actually, it's beyond that, they can't formally exist at the same time. So that means you better pick one variable out of the pair. That means they're conjugate. So same thing with thermodynamics. We have these thermodynamically conjugate pairs. One's extensive, one's intensive. You can use one as the control variable, and then the other one needs to be the dependent variable. So that's the sense in which they're both conjugate. Any other thoughts? Okay. So, here's my question to you about symmetries. Which of these objects is more symmetric?
Yes.
Yes. Who said yes? Okay. Sorry. You had an answer that wasn't yes. What did you just say? And why do you say that? And what do you mean by an axis of symmetry? Okay, so the sphere is more symmetric, meaning what we mean by this is that what kind of symmetry operations can I apply to the thing, the object, and get it back to itself? So a cube, if I rotate a cube, if I stick an axis through the cube and then try to rotate the cube and get it back to itself, I have to rotate it by 90 degrees if it's one of the principal axes of the cube. Whereas a sphere, any axis I stick through the center of the sphere, now I can rotate the sphere by any amount I want, epsilon, up to 90 degrees or more, any of those angles, and I'll get it back. So the sphere has many, many, in fact, an infinite number of symmetry operations I can do on the sphere and get the sphere back to itself, because it's spherically symmetric. But the cube has a finite number that I can do to the cube and get the cube back to itself. I can rotate it by 90 degrees around any of its principal axes. There are some other symmetry operations on it too, but let's just think about rotations. So the sphere is more symmetric. How about ice and water?
Ice.
Now, of course, I said
water.
What I meant for the right-hand side was the liquid water, but obviously I still like graphing from someone else. So pretend this is labeled liquid. Liquid, because they're both water, right? Which is more symmetric? You said ice. Why?
Because you can just get up and move it, and it has symmetry, where the water you can't do necessary.
All right, so now why do you say that about the water? Because you're right, I can take the ice and I can transit the ice by one lattice spacing and I get it back to itself. I can also rotate it by 2 pi divided by 3, I get it back to itself, and so on. And the water, you're arguing that I can't do that with. But what about my time-lapse photography of the water?
Well, I guess if you're talking about, like, over time,
what was that?
Water is more symmetric.
Yeah.
The liquid. Okay, so it actually depends on what time scales I asked the question about. So both answers are correct, but it depends on time scales. So for the ice, the answer is time scale independent. The ice, as long as it's ice, I translate it by one unit cell, it comes back to itself. The water, if I take an instantaneous snapshot, really has no translational symmetries about it. It'll be some random distribution, translate it as much as I want, I'm not going to get it back to itself. But if I took time-lapse photography of the liquid water, then it's one continuous smear, and the smear I can translate by any amount and get back to itself. Now, the trick is, which of those two regimes do we want to think about in thermodynamics? In thermodynamics, as far as defining phases, we're actually concerned with the long-time behavior of things. So we want to work in this limit where we're thinking about the time-lapse photography of the substance. So in our case, for our purposes, the liquid, we're going to consider to be more symmetric, to have, in fact, all those translational symmetries available. Because as I let the system evolve, it will actually explore all of those translational symmetries. But the answer does depend on which time scale you're talking about. Any questions about that? So for the purposes of thermodynamics, we'll consider considering long-time behavior, we will say that the liquid is more symmetric. How about this one? This is a simple one-dimensional solid, which, as we've already stated before, in all honesty, can't exist on its own, but we'll pretend it does for the moment. 1D solid. Do you remember why it can't exist?
Too unstable.
And why? That's right, yeah. So if you break one of the bonds, it's just broken. Whereas if I broke here, oh, this is a great way to do this. I should have had this earlier. Whereas if I break one of these bonds and this guy, there we go. It didn't fall apart. Whereas if I'd had, I'm going to put it back now. Whereas if I'd had a one-dimensional chain and I broke one bond, that's it. Crystal's done. And then thermal fluctuations will cause other bonds to break and it'll just all fall apart. So you can't get a solid in one dimension. You can't get a crystal in one dimension. So what's the symmetry of this guy, even though it doesn't technically exist on its own? Yeah, it's translations. And I can translate it by one unit cell and get it back to itself. Not an epsilon. So in fact, there's a difference between discrete and continuous translations. So discrete or continuous translation symmetry, which is that the crystal has discrete translation symmetry. That is, I have to pick up the crystal and move it by one lattice spacing, or 10 lattice spacings, or 105 lattice spacing. It has to be multiples, integer multiples of the lattice spacing. That means it's a discrete translational symmetry. Whereas a liquid, time-lapse liquid, right, which just looks like a smear, has continuous translational symmetry. I can translate it by an epsilon and get it back to itself. So the symmetry of this guy is discrete translational symmetry. And the symmetry of a solid, symmetry of any phase, determines its behavior in the following sense. The symmetry that it lost, this is kind of weird, right? The crystal, as it forms, loses a symmetry. It loses, you know, if it had been in the liquid phase, where it had this continuous translational symmetry, and then it forms the solid, which is a crystal, and now it has less symmetry. It only has discrete translational symmetry. We say that it's actually broken a symmetry. It's broken the full translational symmetry of the physical laws that it came out of. Now the lowest energy excitations end up telling you about the symmetry that was lost. Okay? So let me take the one-dimensional crystal here, and its lowest energy, what I mean by lowest energy excitations is I mean the lowest energy excited states of the whole system. So the ground state is just one atom next to another in this regular fashion, and they're all sitting still. The next excited state available to the system is a little phonon on it, a very long wavelength phonon on it, where things can wiggle a little bit. And then there are other excited states where it's a phonon that has a higher frequency and a smaller wavelength associated with it. So the lowest energy excitations end up telling you about the symmetry that got lost, the symmetry that got broken. So it remembers the lost symmetry in the actual energy excitation, the excited state structure. Does that make sense? This actually has a name to it. It's called Goldstone's theorem. But you don't need to know that. But know the principle, though. Lowest energy excitations, remember the lost symmetry. Now, one of the ways that we want to categorize phases, then, is by talking about these symmetries. We want to talk about what symmetries does the phase obey, again, at long time scales. Not at short time scales, at long time scales. So, and what we're going to build up with this is methods of talking about the phases and how the phases operate. So I want to build up what's called an order parameter. We could just as easily have called it a symmetry parameter, because what it's about is the symmetries of the phase. So step one in this process is identify the symmetries of the phase. So for my crystal, it's discrete translational symmetry. And what I'm going to call an order parameter is some measurable macroscopic quantity that also has the same symmetry as the phase itself. So I want to look for something I can measure that tells me about the symmetry of the phase. And the order parameter is something that exists in the phase. If you have the phase, the order parameter is non-zero. If the phase melts, for example, the order parameter goes away. It's not there anymore. It's not telling you about things. So it's zero if you're not in the phase. So let me give you the only way to understand this one is by example. So let me give you a few examples of what an order parameter looks like. So ferromagnets. Ferromagnets happen because little atomic moments tend to align. So you could either think about on an atom, the highest unpaired electron has a spin associated with it. That spin, if the spin aligns with the other spins in the sample, they all start pointing in the same direction, you get a magnet. Or I could think about little current loops. So maybe there's an angular momentum associated with the highest unpaired electron, and it's kind of zooming around its atom in a regular manner. That's a little electromagnet, right? A little current loop causes a tiny magnetic field. If all the current loops, if all the orbital angular momentum vectors all line up, you get current loops all in the same direction, and they get one net magnetic field. So either think of this as spin or as orbital angular momentum, like little current loops, and that's the magnetized state. Sorry, here's the box. So the magnetized state, I could tell that I'm in the magnetized state because there's a magnetization associated with it. And I'd measure that the net magnetization is some number that's not zero. If I raise the temperature on this, then even though there's a tendency for them to align, as I turn up the temperature, they can fluctuate and move and things like that. If I turn up the temperature too much, they're just all randomized. So here they get randomized. There's no net magnetization. So this quantity, the magnetization, told me about whether or not I had the phase. So here the order parameter was magnetization. So in what sense do I mean that the magnetization will tell me about the symmetry of the phase? If I'm talking about a ferromagnet.
Between the higher the magnetization, the more...
That's true. The higher the magnetization, the more ordered it is. That's true. What else should be popping up in a magnetization? That's the magnitude.
Direction.
Yeah, there's also a direction. So there's a direction to the magnetization. It'll either point this way, or if all the moments were aligned sideways, the magnetization points sideways. So the order parameter told me something about symmetry in the sense that over here, when I have no net magnetization, then as these moments fluctuate around, if I took the crystal and I rotated it by any amount, I would still not measure any magnetization. The magnetic properties of the crystal are rotationally invariant. Here, once I form the magnet, once I go into the ferromagnetic phase, there's a direction of the crystal now. So if I took the crystal and I flipped it upside down, you could do that magnetization measurement and you'd notice that I flipped the crystal upside down. So the magnetization itself tells you, since the magnetization has chosen a direction, or if I flip it over, the magnetization has chosen the other direction, the order parameter itself is not rotationally symmetric. Just like the phase itself is not rotationally symmetric, because the phase chooses a direction in space for the magnetism to pop out and pick a direction. So the high temperature phase is the one that has more symmetry associated with it. This one is rotationally symmetric. This low temperature magnetized phase is not rotationally symmetric. And the order parameter is also not rotationally symmetric. That's the sense in which the order parameter follows the symmetries. Does that make sense? I see some grimaces out there. Kind of makes sense? Okay, so magnetization is one example. Another example is antiferromagnets. This is where the ordered state looks like the little atomic magnets have anti-aligned. So there's an electronic moment here. It could be the spin. It could be the angular moment, orbital angular momentum. And it's aligned one way. Its neighbor is aligned the other way. Sometimes this happens. Sometimes the little angular momentum moments tend to oppositely align. And if I go through now and ask myself, well, is that magnetized? I wouldn't detect that through the same experiment as I did for the ferromagnet. If I measured the net magnetization, well, half the moments are up, half the moments are down. So there's no net magnetization. But something happened here. It's different from the disordered phase where all the spins can point in any direction. In both these cases, the net magnetization is zero because there's no ferromagnetism. What we do in this case is we say, well, look, the right thing to notice is that some spins are up, some spins are down, so there's a staggered magnetization. I'll take all the up spins minus all the down spins. notice that there's still going to be a direction to that. So what I want to do is say, look, every other site is up, every other site is down. So I'll take up direction minus down direction. So the up magnetization minus the down magnetization. And it'll still point in a particular direction, because if the spins were aligned sideways, I'd still have up magnetization minus down magnetization. So I take what's called the staggered magnetization, every other site. One site minus its next site, and so on. This is the order parameter here. Yeah?
For this particular case, that would be zero, right?
What would be zero?
The net magnetization.
Net magnetization is zero in both cases here.
In,
right.
In the direction also, right?
In all directions, the net magnetization is zero. But if I count on only every other site, I'd see a magnetization. So that's what I want to do, is take the magnetization on every other site, subtract it from all the atoms I left out, and then I get an actual order parameter. And so the order parameter, being the staggered magnetization, is something if the phase happened. It's zero if the phase is disordered. And it also captures the fact that there's a directionality to this phase. That when they choose this up-down pattern, they had to do it in with a particular orientation. That this is a different anti-ferromagnet from that. Any other questions? Here, a pneumatic chooses a direction in space. So pneumatics are when the long floppy molecules have all more or less chosen a direction. We can talk about an order parameter here, which is direction. And really what we mean is, look, there's some alignment here to the pneumatic. There's some alignment here to the pneumatic. The order parameter in this case is a bit odd, because I can't formally tell the difference between the pneumatic running up versus down. There is no distinction because they're long floppy molecules that if I flipped each one of them by 180 degrees, I couldn't tell the difference. So the right way to think of it is it's kind of an up-down thing. So we often call this a headless vector, and that it doesn't matter, you know, up versus down is the exact same thing. So this has a kind of a funny mathematical structure to it, and you really need a matrix to represent it, but that's a pneumatic. So this headless vector that tells you the direction is something when it's in the pneumatic phase, but it's zero if it melts and it's not in the pneumatic phase anymore. And the order parameter, again, breaks all the symmetries that the ordered phase breaks. The ordered phase breaks rotational symmetry. The pneumatic, once it's aligned up, I can tell the difference between that versus sideways. And the order parameter will follow that symmetry breaking. A crystal. A crystal has discrete translational symmetry. So I can take the atoms in the crystal, take the crystal and translate it by one lattice spacing, I get it back to itself. So it's got a smaller symmetry set than the liquid. So the order parameter I'm looking for will also have the same symmetries about it. And the right order parameter in this case is to take a Fourier component. So let me take the density in the crystal as a function of position. So for example, what I mean by that is there's a spike in the density here where there's an atom. In between the atoms, the density is zero. And there's a density here where the atom is, and then in the next bit, it's zero. So if I try to turn this into a function, it's really a, let's see, the one-dimensional, do the one-dimensional example is best here. A one-dimensional crystal would have a density wave, too many things in my hands, two more hands. So the one-dimensional crystal, if I tried to write out, well gosh, what's its density? Often we represent that by rho. The function here would be, look, there's a lot where there's an atom, and there's nothing, and there's something with an atom, something with an atom, something. So I have a repeat, I have a signal with a repeat time, and I take the Fourier, if I take the Fourier transform of this, I get one nice big spike, rho of k, at some k that equals 2 pi over lambda. Okay. So the Fourier transform of the density will tell me something about what's going on inside the crystal. Any questions about that? Superfluids are weird. In a superfluid, and this took people a while to figure out, the right, or a superconductor, the right thing is the wave function that all the bosons go into. So all the bosons flock down into the lowest wave function. And that's considered the order parameter. Do you... Can anybody spot the symmetry that's being broken there? There's a broken symmetry associated with that. It's really weird and subtle. I'll be really impressed if you spot it. when I say that a superfluid has happened, I say that there's a real wave, there's a wave function that has a particular amplitude and a particular phase, and that the phase is constant throughout the sample. So the symmetry that ends up getting broken in the superfluid is gauge symmetry. Because the phase is not supposed to matter. Phase of a wave function shouldn't matter. But in a superfluid or a superconductor, we get something where it's got a particular phase. And it ends up mattering. So here's our summary slide here of various types of symmetries. And so we said that there's some sort of order parameter that happens in an ordered phase. Ordered phases break a symmetry. They have smaller symmetry sets than disordered phases. And there's some sort of order parameter we can come up with that will have the same symmetry properties. So that's what we want to do with the order parameter. And broken symmetries, the crystal is a broken symmetry in the sense that if it melted, it would now regain its full translational symmetries, all of them, even the continuous translational symmetries. So broken symmetries lead to an order parameter, just like we went through all those order parameters, and a rigidity. Okay, so what's an example of a rigidity? A rigidity is some sort of restoring force. So in the squishy crystal, the rigidity is the actual rigidity. It's the fact that it's solid and it's a hard solid and it pushes back when I push on it. So when I try to displace an atom, the atom pushes back. In the magnet, oh wow, I can't spell the word once. Anyway, in a magnet, all the moments align, and if I took one of the moments and I tried to tilt it away, the rest of the ferromagnet actually tends to pull it back. So there's a rigidity there, it's kind of a spin rigidity, or a stiffness to the magnetic moment direction. So there's always a rigidity that comes up in these things. And the pneumatic, same thing. If I have all the pneumatic molecules and they're mostly aligned, and I try to pull one away from the alignment direction, that costs energy, so it tends to pull back. Whereas if it was all disordered, it wouldn't matter. I could take one and flip it. Who cares? Temperature's already disrupted it so much. But if it's in its ordered phase and I pull one, it pulls back. So in pneumatics, are a bit weird because they're technically liquid-like. The molecules can exist in any relation with each other, so it's a smear, but there's a particular direction. So pneumatics actually can be poured, but they can't bend. So they'll flow, but don't try to get it to flow through a channel that's going to bend. They resist bending because their molecules resist twisting. Crystals were the first example I gave, that when I push on one of the atoms, it pushes back. So every time you have a phase that breaks a symmetry, we can delineate what symmetries were retained and which ones were broken. We can define an order parameter which has the symmetries of the phase. And we also get something new, a rigidity that comes out. And these are, it doesn't matter what type of magnet you have. These kinds of principles will be independent of, was this a magnet that's made out of this type of material or this type of material? It won't matter. Was it a rare earth magnet or an iron magnet? Won't matter. What kind of pneumatic was it? Won't matter. Whether it's made out of these long floppy molecules or those other long floppy molecules. What kind of crystal? Won't matter. It'll still have the same type of order parameter and the same rigidity. So, and again, rigidity is this kind of emergence thing. And it's a bit odd, right? Rigidity ends up leading to a kind of action at a distance. So the table, for example, is rigid. And when I push on the table, the whole table moves. So there's this action at a distance in that I pushed on this edge of the table, and I can instantaneously move the other edge of the table. Okay, so it just somehow magically acts like one big object. And that sort of, this is L. An example of emergence, universal macroscopic properties that come out of the mess of all those atoms together. They self-organize. So we already went through most of this, that what happens in those cases is that fundamentally new laws are emerging in many body systems. The rigidity being one of those things that pops up. Any kind of crystal you have will be rigid. Doesn't matter what kind of crystal it was. It's simply due to the fact that the crystal now doesn't have all the symmetries of free space. It only has discrete translational symmetry. When you break discrete translational symmetry, you get a rigidity. It also means that you lost the conservation law, by the way, but that's a side issue. But you get these new overriding principles that pop up in these kind of things. When I put this symbol here, that means it's a really advanced concept. Okay, so these are advanced statistical mechanics ideas. So again, you know, you've seen this happen in everyday life. You can get a wave in a baseball stadium. You can get a government. You can get an economy. You can get families, really large families, depending on where you're from. I have a very large extended family on both sides. And these are new things that aren't available if you have only one particle to study, but there's still universal properties that'll happen. So in infinite microscopic details, some universal things pop up. Now, we have to end class. And what we're going to do with this, though, next time, okay, is we're going to take these ideas of symmetries and order parameters and use the order parameter to develop a general theory of phase transitions. All right, so that's where we're headed. Come back next time for Landau's theory of phase transition.
Do we need this to do the homework this due Friday?
Do you need
the stuff that you're going to do later to do the homework?
On Wednesday? Yeah, we'll finish it Wednesday.
Oh, right, because it's Monday, not Wednesday.
Today's Monday.
Yeah.
We'll be okay. You needed the land, you needed the van der Waals, present state, that stuff. Yes, come. We're done. See you Wednesday. Right. What? Yeah, gauge invariance, yeah?
What is that?
What is that? Oh, gauge invariance. Gauge invariance is the idea that the physics of the same independent of the phase of the wave function. So wave functions are complex numbers, they have amplitude of phase. And all physical quantities that come up depend on the output of the wave function. And all of your expectation values, if I had some sort of quantity, let's say momentum, for example, if I want to be this quantity, what we usually do is straight, well, I mean this, that's the rack notation, or if I wrote out this, I would really mean this minus I HRG by the X upside X dx. Notice that the phases, when you can come in complex times, you get. So all your physical, they won't get a name. Your phase isn't in here. So all your physical observables are independent of the phase. That's what gauge invariance means. I could change the gauge into the phase. I could change the phase of the wave function and you don't do this.
So if you had a total function, they all go into the same phase. Yeah. One tries to change the phase a bit.
Actually, yeah. That's exactly what happens. They all go to the same one, and then one of the characters, I'm going to change my phase.
They're like, uh-uh.
Right. There's a rigidity associated with it. There's a phase difference associated with it.
So, and that's why they're sticky?
Yeah. Like, no. This is actually one of the macroscopic things.
Oh, I mean, that's why.
So, you know how I'm not going to get this question right. There is a current density in quantum mechanics, which has factors out in front, which basically depends on psi star del psi minus psi del psi star with factors out in front. If I take into account this fact that there's a gauge that's broken in the superfluid, and now I let maybe this part over here is going to choose a slightly different phase, turns out that will cause particles to flow and push the phase back. What it was. So you can see that by say that I have some amplitude that's constant everywhere, I'll get an overall size squared everywhere, but then I'll get a del phi popping out.
Terrorists, you kidnap.
And so a gradient in the, I did that math way too fast, but you can work it out.
Everyone,
same answer. And there's a gradient of the phase, and the gradient of the phase will drive current. So if I have a superfluid and I twist the phase, that actually tends to cause the fluid to flow. The fluid will flow over there and then it'll push the phase back. And it corrects the rigidity. I mean, there's a rigidity there that corrects the phase twist that you put on it.
So if you can
Get a superconductor, it's a little easier to see how you would do it. Because if you force a current to flow, you're forced to phase.
Yeah.
So in a superconductor, it's actually a voltage.
Okay, so you cause
a voltage to switch the phase.
Okay, so you apply a voltage which makes some of the electron pairs to go out of phase.
Right.
And then
right.
That makes the current flow.
Right.
So I was thinking
was
maybe
I took it, and I tested it.
If you can make current, you could do something useful.
Unfortunately, I just use it.
Ah, seems like you have no five volts.
Okay.
And that actually twists the phase. Yeah.
So I will be here.
Oh, all right.
I have a better explainer to you.
Oh, nice. Good luck. Okay, so you can get the notes out online. You should be okay. Actually, these notes today will finish what you need to know.
Do you have
just
that?
Okay. Good luck.
Thanks.
Nice spotting the conjugate variables. I think you might be right. It's not clear to me in which case. Yeah, I mean, the time and energy is a bit tricky because I don't know how I would argue that they're quantum mechanically conjugate. They definitely obey a Heisenberg uncertainty principle.
Right.
Yeah. And,
why time and energy are conjugate?
Time and energy follow an uncertainty principle.
Oh, okay, so you want to see how, if you took TE, if you get an I.
But I don't know if there's any sense in which I can say that this is true.
You think of time.
That's my problem. I'm not entirely sure about that. But I do know that this follows the same pattern as momentum and position, because with momentum and position, you had x with p is I, that's h bar. Mm-hmm. And that directly led to the uncertainty principle. I. And the translation operator is u v I divided by amount x equals a is that p dot a. And I don't think this is actually true, but it is true that I can translate by a particular time a wave function by applying EVI